focused on, you know, single issue plays or kitchen sink plays or living room plays or sofa plays, that we can be, we can actually be making theater that forces us to imagine other possibilities, that lives in a different register, that moves really rapidly between lyrical language and the language of the everyday, the verbatim text, like what you heard in Daniel's work.
You're also a playwright yourself. Do you also love the spoken language?
I do. I do. I think that that's probably what first led me into playwriting is I was actually working this weird telemarketing job. I was telemarketing for a theater, and I was having these phone conversations with people every night, and I was listening to the things they said to me on the phone and listening to the other callers in the room around me. And I was a really bad telemarketer, like a tragically bad telemarketer, because I spent my whole time just taking notes on what I was hearing and not selling any theater tickets at all.
I was
fired from that job, but it did launch me into writing, because I was so fascinated by what I was hearing.
Well, Kate Kramer, this is delightful. Thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's been an absolute delight.
Kate Kramer is an English instructor at the University of Virginia College at Wise. She's also a playwright and editor of 53rd State Press. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Jessica Del Vecchio is a theater professor at James Madison University. She says 10 years ago, if she asked a classroom of college students whether they were feminists, most of them would say no. But today, Del Vecchio's class, Feminism and Performance, has a long waiting list. Culture has shifted, and at the front lines of that shift, you'll find experimental theater. Jessica, you're writing about a new kind of experimental feminist theater that you first started noticing in New York City a while back. Tell me about your experience.
Yeah, so I moved to New York City in the late 90s, and I was seeing a lot of experimental theater that was very interesting. But it seemed to me to not be very engaged politically, and it certainly wasn't explicitly feminist. And an example of that is a company that I love very much, Elevator Repair Service. They had done a number of shows, and I noticed that an actor in the company, Susie Sokol, was playing male roles in a number of their pieces, and specifically Jack Kerouac in an amazing production called No Great Society. And so I interviewed the company about these choices, and I said, you know, I'm kind of reading, you know, a sort of feminist and queer politics here. And they said, you know, it's fine that you're reading that, but that's not what we're doing. We are just interested in aesthetics. And that was kind of the vibe of experimental theater in New York in the early 2000s. And then I went away to grad school in Texas, and I came back, and I was outside of a theater in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and I ran into Brooke O'Hara, who was the founder and director of a company called the Theater of a Two-Headed Calf, whose work I really loved, but whose work never really seemed to me to be explicitly feminist or queer. And she said to me, you'll be really interested. Our company formed a Dyke division, and we're doing a live lesbian soap opera called Room for Cream, and you should come. And it was this hilarious serial piece called Room for Cream, set in an imagined lesbian feminist utopia hidden somewhere in the Berkshires. And it had a huge cast of, you know, very diverse people. And it sort of made me realize that there was a shift in experimental theater in New York City.
Right. And what do you think was happening in Room for Cream?
Room for Cream is really interesting because of the way that it both relies on the label of lesbian and the specificity of that label, but then it also expands it to sort of encompass anyone who was living in Sappho and who was in this piece. So it both needs that category, but then complicates that category. So for me, sitting in the audience and the way that the show was staged, the audience could actually sit at tables that were part of Room for Cream, which was the name of the coffee shop in Sappho where all of these people hung out. So you were really, you were invited to be a part of this community and imagine yourself in, you know, this lesbian feminist utopia that's free of any kind of divisions that might, divide us in real life.
Why did you realize that this wasn't just a one-off, that this was the beginning of sort of a new thing in feminist theater?
So then I saw a piece called Nurses in New England by the company Half Straddle, which was a theater company founded by writer and director Tina Satter. And it was a musical set in an all-nurse-run hospital where the women who work there do the very tough work of saving sick stuffed animals. And it was this very girly aesthetic. It was all pinks and purples and these pop songs and, discussions of hair and makeup. And it was also kind of a takeoff on Grey's Anatomy. And the lead character, played by Jess Barbagallo, was named Dr. Derek Shepherd.
He's the dreamy one, Dr. McDreamy.
Dr. McDreamy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then that's when I realized, okay, this isn't just a one-off. This is something that, all of a sudden companies are claiming the label of feminist and making work that is explicitly feminist. Half Straddle also did a piece called In the Pony Palace Football that was a kind of abstract exploration of this all-women high school football team and cheerleading squad. And it was really popular. It premiered to sold-out audiences at the Bushwick Star. And it was a kind of feminist reimagining of the television series Friday Night Lights, a critically acclaimed series about a small town in Texas and their high school football team. So Satter and Barbagallo had both recently rewatched the series and, loved it, and so wanted to make a piece in which the football team was all women. And it's not a parody of Friday Night Lights. It's asking audiences to take that choice seriously.
Help me think about your reaction to it. How did it help alter your perception of football and the capacity of women and others to engage?
Yeah, so it made me think of two things. It made me reflect on a show like Friday Night Lights, which I also loved, and the representations, for example, of masculinity in that show, and how,
right,
how very limited our representations of gender are in popular culture. So it made me think about that. And it also made me think about these girly aesthetics in general and how adolescent girlhood is often dismissed and often seen as a joke in a way, or seen as something silly, like the right, artifacts of girlhood. And I was really moved by Half Straddle asking us to take those things seriously. And to see it as a queer time, an inherently queer time, because this, all of the romances in this show are inherently queer. So it's also asking us to see, to reimagine adolescence as an inherently queer identity-forming time. I think that this work is presenting us with the possibility of queerer, more feminist worlds, and to allow an audience to imagine that, I think, in the space of the theater, allows you to imagine that in the real world as well.
You've named this new kind of theater that you were seeing post-wave pop feminist theater?
Yes.
What does that mean?
So in the U.S., moments of feminist engagement have traditionally been referred to as waves. So the first wave being the move for women's suffrage in the early 20th century, and then the second wave being the women's liberation movement of the late 60s, 70s, and early 80s, and then third wave being late 80s into the 90s.
How would you describe the feminism of this wave?
Yeah, so in terms of what I'm seeing in the theater, there's an intergenerational quality to this work. So, you know, in Room for Cream, we have a huge cast. We have casts of people from all different generations. This work is saying, in order to move feminism forward, we need to listen to some of these voices from the past that may have been left out. And maybe the clearest example is Danielle Alexander Jones's performances as Jo Mama Jones, who is a diva from the 70s who's come back to do shows today. And in the performance Blacklight, for example, she says, you know, things from the 60s still work, right? And she says, you know, I'm from the future. And so here we have this performer performing a character who's from the 60s and 70s, who's bringing a message to today's audiences about how to move feminism forward. So I feel like that's really, to me, the spirit of post-wave. Like, listen, you know, listen to this woman, because things from the 60s still work.
Right. And what about the pop part of the feminism?
Yeah, so the other thing that I noticed about this work is that it's really in conversation with popular culture.
Right.
You know, Nurses in New England was in conversation with Grey's Anatomy, In the Pony Palace, Football's in conversation with Friday Night Lights. I would say that Room for Cream is a kind of anti-L word in a way. So I think there's a love for popular culture that's evidenced in this work, but also a critique of it.
Most of us don't attend experimental theater performance or don't have access to them. How do you think the rest of us experience the impact of these early works?
Yeah, so I think that what happens on experimental stages then sort of reaches the mainstream years later. Yeah. For example, in 2014, Beyoncé on the very large stage at the VMAs with the word feminist in white lights behind her. And then, you know, to see articles being written about, is feminism trendy now, and that kind of thing. So to really see a shift in, you know, mainstream culture from being this sort of feminism is over kind of thing to a real feminist engagement. So I think that we can sometimes look to experimental work for clues about what might happen in the larger culture in the next few years.
Well, Jessica, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Jessica Delvecchio is a professor of theater at James Madison University. When we teach math to third graders, we use songs and games and movement. But step into a college math class, and you're likely to see rows of students staring ahead at a teacher talking. Kerrigan Sullivan is a theater professor at John Tyler Community College. She says that the interaction and games of improv can and should be used in college classrooms, regardless of the subject being taught. Kerrigan, teachers of young children use a lot of games and activities to help them not just learn, but also to enjoy learning. Why do you think by the time we hit college, there's almost none of that?
You know, it's interesting because it's almost like we think that kinesthetic learning or active learning just ends the second that you learn to read, or that you develop a longer attention span so that you can maybe sit in a lecture and listen to information. But that's not true. That's kind of a fallacy. But for some reason, we think that being an adult means that you give up on play.
That's so true. But do you actually think that this form of active play and role-playing and improv in class works for all kinds of learning? Surely not math and chemistry and that sort.
Well, so I think there's an interesting fallacy there. There was an article recently in the Harvard Gazette that did a survey on active learning, and they did it in, I believe, STEM classrooms, so very much, you know, science, technology, engineering, math. And half of them did these, like, stellar, amazing lectures, and the other professors did these active learning techniques. And they found that the students that actually had the active learning had learned more. However, they thought that they learned more from the stellar lectures. So there's two things about that that connect with your point. One is that there's a little bit of, we've kind of tricked ourselves into thinking that we learn better just by listening. But the opposite is actually true. And it doesn't matter necessarily the subject matter. You can always find a way to teach that in an active way. Now, it may not be the same way that a literature class might use it, but there's definitely ways to incorporate active learning and improvisation techniques into pretty much any discipline that you can think of. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with college professors in other disciplines, and I get a lot back, especially from the sort of STEM folks, like, well, this can't possibly work in chemistry, you know? But I think that if you actually sit down and have a conversation, that you can find ways that absolutely it can work in chemistry. I talk about some work of John P. Walters, who used role-playing techniques to teach analytical chemistry. That worked really well. So, you know, if you can use role-playing to teach analytic chemistry, I think you can probably make it work for pretty much anything.
Give me an idea of what that would look like. How do you use role-playing to teach principles in chemistry?
Yeah, and you know, so a lot of this and what the Harvard folks did was basically a problem-solving approach using role-playing. So you have a real-life chemistry situation. So maybe there's an assembly line crisis and, you know, the mix of the pill has been adulterated and you've got to separate out the bronze alloy, you know, from the bronze bearing. How are you going to do that? And you set it up so one student might be the company CEO, another student might be the public relations director. So, and you give them a little bit of an idea of what their perspective on this is. And then you let them role play it out. So that's problem solving. And you could do that with pretty much anything.
You've even said that principles as seemingly dry or cerebral as, let's say, the Pythagorean theorem mm-hmm. in mathematics mm-hmm. can be mm-hmm. acted out by students. They can enjoy it and maybe remember it better.
Right. There's several different approaches to it. I mean, you could take it and say like, okay, I want you to physically recreate this formula with your bodies. And it could almost just be like the YMCA thing where you're trying to make that formula physically. But even just that involvement of the physicality, the kinesthetic involvement, and the idea of using your bodies to form these words, you know, or this formula, that could simply be one thing. And also, frankly, it's a lot of fun. People will laugh. You know, it's like if you're trying to make an equal sign, how do you do that? Let's make a triangle together. What does that look like, you know? So you could literally do it like that. You could also take the principle of it. So if you were looking at, I don't know, states of matter or something, or you're saying, okay, you guys walk around the classroom, you're water. Now I've just raised the temperature to 180 degrees. What happens? You know, what does that look like? If you give yourself and the students permission to mess up or to look silly or to be weird or strange or however you want to term it, you know, once that happens and everybody kind of gets to a space where they can kind of be crazy together, there's some really wonderful connections that can happen. And honestly, every single semester that I teach improv, I am surprised and delighted by the ideas that the students bring in.
For teachers of all sorts of different kinds of classes, you advise two things for all of them. And one is that they set the stage to make it a welcoming atmosphere. And the other thing is, it's not easy for the teacher. You actually have to really know what you're doing.
Yeah, you know, those two things are so important. So first of all, you know, the setting the space. If you have students come in on the first day and you just have them sit there and you read the syllabus to them, then that sets them up kind of automatically for a semester of passive listening, passive involvement, right? And also the biggest thing too is that I think you have to really open yourself up as a teacher to be able to not say no to students and not shut them down, you know? If you kind of have them and you're like, oh, well, that's not the right way to do that. That's not the way to do this. They'll shut down pretty quickly. So you have to be very accepting and open of those first impulses and allow them to kind of, you know, flounder around, allow those mistakes to happen. And you're not always in charge in a way. You know, you're leading, you're guiding, but you're not this authoritarian figure with all the power and all of the control. So letting go of that control and that power, it can feel pretty scary, especially when you're first doing it.
I remember a child who came home weeping from the first day of middle school because mm-hmm. she'd gone to maybe six different teachers and gotten the same lecture about what the ground rules were going to be for the semester. I yeah. love that you've apparently taken the first day of school with your college students and given them the same ground rules, but done it in an improv way?
Absolutely. So when I first started teaching, you know, at the college level, there was this, I was told, like, okay, well, so on the first day of class, you pretty much just go and you go over the syllabus, right? And I got to my acting class and I thought, this is ridiculous. This is the opposite of what I want these students to be doing this whole time. There's got to be a different way to do this. So I played syllabus charades with my students. I made up some sort of silly headlines for my policies that were like, you know, crazed co-ed learns that they've got, you know, three absences from a tardy or whatever it is. And, you know, it'd be like a sort of mock headline about one of my policies or something that was important about the class, a major assignment, et cetera. And then I mixed those in with headlines like, you know, vegan vampire attacks trees or, and then I put them in groups and they would act out these different headlines for the class. And honestly, it is one of the most fun activities that I do. I really love it. And actually, you know, the syllabus is probably one of the driest, most academic documents that you could try to teach. So I figure if that works in the charades and interactive format, there's got to be a way to make anything else work.
Totally. Give me some of the other games you might play or suggest or you've seen played in different subjects.
You know, one really, really simple sort of game concept is something called statues. The basic concept is just that you're going to have the students make statues with their bodies. Right, physically. So it can either be one single sort of like freeze frame, like here, create this formula with your bodies and show it to the class, or it could be something where it's like take six still shots and show me the battle of whatever. You know, I did this once with a class that we were studying Romeo and Juliet, and I had them do sort of six shots of the story, and then I let them rewrite the ending. and in those six frames. So it was like, first tell me what was actually on the page. Give me six shots of Romeo and Juliet. And the fun thing was, of course, you know, they come up with these, it's incredibly gruesome. Everybody, you know, is being poisoned and dying and all that. And then when they had them rewrite the ending, it was pretty much just like the letter was delivered and nobody died and everybody, you know, lived happily ever after. Or Romeo and Juliet just eloped and they lived their life. So there's a lot of things that happened that are a lot of fun. Another game that I really like is a talk show. So you can have students either be a character or you can have them be an expert in a certain thing. And then you do sort of like a talk show kind of thing and you can decide whether you're more of, you know, a Jerry Springer or a Dr. Phil or an Oprah in your talk show style. And you interview them. And that is something where you get just really great responses and stuff, especially when students are not characters, but concepts or ideas, or they're experts on certain things. We did one once where one of the students was like a refrigerator or a toaster or something for some reason. And they were so clever with their responses about just saying, like, for the toaster, they were like, yeah, I just like to pop up sometimes and, you know, come around to this. And it's just like that way of getting into that creative space where you're not thinking logically. And I think some of that in some ways is the key to it, where you can be thinking about higher concepts, but not in a logical way, if that makes sense.
So what do you say to professors and teachers who are really tempted by this and come back to that first thing you said, they feel pressed for time?
So I think that you have to make choices about what the most important or best information to do in these formats is. And it doesn't necessarily take more time if you target it and you decide, like, I'm going to take, if this is the most important concept of the year or the most important concept of the week or whatever it is, you know, you're going to take one piece of it this week for this concept. We're going to take half an hour and do it this way. I think that if you continue to do that, that you will see results. And again, you've got to start from the beginning with little things to do all along the way. You've got to keep people in motion, because once they come to rest, then it's very, very hard to get them moving again. But I think that in some ways our educational system has kind of come to this place of rest where we feel like, oh no, this is working. But it's not. It's not really working, you know? And there's a lot of evidence to show where it's not working, you know? Just because we feel more comfortable with it and we feel like it's working does not actually mean that it's the best choice.
I'm really inspired. Kerrigan Sullivan, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Morgan Sullivan is a theater professor at John Tyler Community College, which is becoming Bright Point Community College. For unique handmade gifts for book and art lovers in your life, visit the Virginia Center for the Book Raucous Auction online. You'll find artist-made prints, books, experiences, and one-of-a-kind works through November 4th. Go to vabookcenter.org. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a web and new media coordinator. Our web and new media coordinator is responsible for KBOO's website and social media accounts. Applicants should have experience administering